lovely looking lectern, I think, with a quote on it.
Lovely but unreliable.
Is it? Okay. That's all. So interesting hearing Australian pronunciations for Australian places and names. I don't feel too bad when I Rosie, some of those things are just amazing, and I'm going to probably get them wrong now when I read. Let me see. I usually work in theatre, and I had a reading at Galway, and now I'm reading here, and I'm not used to necessarily having to not go to the toilet beforehand, so I'm always sort of like running to the toilet and then coming here. But I think my first love for theatre has I've had this passion for Lady Macbeth, and it's inspired a number of my poems. So I think I might start with a poem called Lady M from the last book that I wrote.
Ah, she's a devious woman.
She is. So this takes license with a very famous speech from Lady Macbeth. Yet here's a spot, a soul-kicking scene, cinematic, catastrophic clarity. Out, I say. The actress sits on their toilet. The actor lies in their bed. One, two. Him, Macbeth. Why then, 'tis time to do it. Leave the cinema, go to the bathroom, turn on your phone, a message. Hell is murky. After 3 years, Macbeth calls, and what were you doing? What? Will his hands now be clean? Phone off in Adelaide watching a movie. No more of that. The past is a ripped, backless dress with his fingerprints on it. But why do you have to sleep with all three witches? Wash your hands. Your life stretches before you. The hours. The hours. Put on your nightgown. The actress leaves the ensuite, gets in bed beside the actor. Look not so pale. The actress is a-plotting. Mrs. Dalloway. Lady Macbeth. Come, come, come. The actor has his own plot. His actress will play house. Give me your hand. Blood binds them now. To him, it's simple. To her, it's not. To bed, to bed, to bed. Lie next to your enemy. Slay the one you love. So this book charts from an early love of Lady Macbeth and thinking she was such a cool, sexy character, and then actually going into a place that was a very similar depression, a bit of an agitated depression that I think Lady Macbeth must have had, and Shakespeare got it so right. I no longer wanted to play Lady Macbeth, ever, but this book does document a kind of breakup, and I think if you probably listened to that last poem, it was about been in a relationship that, I don't know if anyone's seen that movie, The Hours, is it Stephen? Mm-hmm. Is it, yeah. Where, you know, the person sits there thinking, oh my God, who is this person that I have to go and lie next to? And feeling that you got it all wrong and you have children with this person. But for me, there were 10 easy steps out of it, and this poem is called 10 Easy Steps. One, rats, prescription drugs and fortnightly lovers lie strewn around my toes. I cry and the room floods. Somewhere the sound of rain. I swim towards the Dead Sea, paint my body with its green-black mud. I am covered, all but my eyes, shining the same colour as the body paint. Two, the water becomes denser as I reach the salty sea. I struggle to swim any further. You are here with someone else. She, your new love, looks blankly at me. My body starts to convulse. I dry retch again and again. She is painted like me, but her eyes pierce blue. I flap about like a seal lost in foreign waters. Three. I swim on. The Dead Sea moves thickly into the oil-drenched Gulf of New Mexico. My body moves slower. It becomes harder to continue. I pass death and fear. I finally get to play Lady Macbeth. 4. Repeat after me. I am in a psychiatric hospital. 5. I look through your shape as I pass my sleeping 2-year-old over into hands I no longer know. She wakes, hugs you and smiles. You take her away from me. It is your weekend. 6. Without children, my body aches. It needs dimension, lacks depth. I play the piano for 48 hours. My fingers bleed. My mind counts fingering. Notes sound into the night. It fills the hole until they come home. 7. It is Mother's Day when you return the children at the appointed time, at the appointed place. You try to look at me without me seeing. I look good. I am fine. I am me. What did you expect? 8. Handing leftover muesli because you can't afford to take it on the plane, you know you have started a dirty game. I won't know until a week later when I open the legal letter. The final trump card, you think, to hurt me, to crush what is left. I will rise above your dark waters. I was always the better swimmer. I toss the muesli in the bin. 9. I'm in a hot shower washing off the oil slick from my heart and toes. It sticks, it is stubborn. But when I step out, I have washed you away. 10. I catch a movement out of the corner of my eye. Black oil bubbling up with steady, deadly reflexes. I place a bare foot over the shower drain. I squash the last of you through the steel holes. It tickles my feet. Today, along with John and Robin and various friends, we went and visited Cove. Okay, let's see if anyone get to mispronounce something, probably. And, you know, we went to the museum and walked through where the people went for the Titanic and was wandering up the little stairs. And there's a place in Sydney called The Rocks. Has anyone been to The Rocks in Sydney? It's where most people would have landed when they came on the first fleet. So I was reminded of that, so I thought I'd read a poem. And, of course, our little alleys are nothing like your little alleys here. But there's a very famous book in Australia called Playing Beatty Bo. And, John, you probably have read it, but I studied it at school, and it's about a time-travelling, a child that, you know, can travel back in time when she runs upstairs, which in Australia is only very, you know, 200 years at the most. So when we come here, or when I come here, I get absolutely overwhelmed with the history. But this poem really is about wanting to turn back time, I suppose. Playing Beatty Bo. The Argyle steps twisting memories and times. Modern art sits on the landing place of the First Fleet. Drinking holes full of stories, you rocky rocks pubs. Where the shark arm murder was plotted. Where she first had sex with her Irish man and where, a few years later, her faux doctor told her he loved her. Wait, no, he said, you realise I'm in love with you. It wasn't a question. Where the real underbelly roll around and conspire to kill the wrong man. Revenge in the end is symbolic. Running up the nurse's walk, its narrowness pressing time and flesh together, she heard his name on someone else's painted lips. A stunning tattooed blonde proudly showing her diamond through cigarette smoke. The words cut. A chisel hammers into her heart. She stops breathing. She is too late. For a heartbeat, she plays Beatty Bo, wills him to press her against the hard, cold sandstone of the nurse's walk, hold her wrists, look at her in the eyes. Then it's gone. Street performers and fairies drown the moment for now. Somewhere over Sydney Harbour, red wine is shared. A playwright in his day job writes a 90-page condition report for a building with white sails. Before Uzon's Benelong, a furry girl with coffee black eyes dodges bedpans and love, searching slums for answers for the fear beneath her skin. You can't change anything. Even the staff toilets are heritage, amplifies the playwright's voice across the cool, flat water. Something about that she likes. Even if it takes 10 people to get to this point of inaction, the staff toilets will stay, the nurse's walk will stay, and the Argyle cuts scars forever on her wrists. I'm going to read one other piece before I read a few love poems, but this is a new thing, and it's from something I've been working on as part of my doctorate, and it's about... It's really part of a book. I've called it C&C, but so a lot of the voices will overlap. But I was pretty pissed off about a lot of the censorship that happened in Australia over the children in detention. And when I was working in theatre, one of the plays that I wrote, this is back in 2003, had just one mention of a child in detention. And this is, you know, children that come out here as refugees from all over the place. And Australia has been very good at putting them in prison camps, and often they die. And there's a lot of cover-up, and a lot of the work that has been written about it has been censored. So this book that I've been working on is about that. And it, look, I'm just going to read it like a bit of a stream of consciousness C in Feeder, which is what it's called. So some voices might not work, but bear with me. It's the first time I've read it. The moonlight did not reach the sea floor unless it was shining in full. Be it storm moon, rose moon, old moon or ice moon, hot moon, wolf moon or honeymoon. The equation was always the same. The cries of the women and girls reached out to each other like an echoing shell. The listener could hear silent sobs through the one ocean. And somewhere in suburban Australia, a woman picks up a magazine in a supermarket and sees a picture of a young girl from Basra who has been adopted by celebrity parents. A young girl who has no idea her little playmate's body organs had started to shut down in a detention centre in South Australia. The woman closes the magazine and leaves the shop with a bit of taste in her mouth. The perfect family framed for consumption to leave the reader feeling starving. The Salem witches and wild roses, the naughty girls, the innocent girls, the children overboard, the murderesses, the poetesses, the actresses, their long tresses and their dresses swirling out into the sea's arms. She was their mother now. She clung to them tight. What the sea wants, she wants. The motherless find the daughterless in the red tide. The fake and the real, the refugee and the traveller, the faithful and the faithless, the propaganda and the silence, the fact and the fiction, the hurly-burly of truth. A woman on a train says to another in Sydney, "I don't even know where Christmas Island is." And the other one answers, "No, and I don't care." When I'm silent, I cease to exist. What the sea wants, she wants. Deep in the thunderbolts of the sea, under the darkness of memory, the pressure of water was breaking and crushing her frame. She watched the scene on the boat from above, saw men roughly push her daughter to the floor of the boat. She screamed to her to not fight them, but no words came out. She saw her husband with his head in his hands, and she saw the fear on everyone's faces. She smelt the fear on the Australian soldiers the most. It confused her. Why were they so scared of these exhausted children and families, she thought? They could not hurt them. They were at their mercy. Mercy. And from the bottom of the sea, she sings to her child. She sees her as a small baby she held close. She sees her as a young child running towards her. She feels her growing inside her belly, taking her first steps. And hears her terrified cry as she fell over into the sea and left her on the boat. She sees her in a continuous stream of connection. She cries through the weight of water, longing for her form. When she is silent, she ceases to exist. She hears her husband's prayers and her child's cries. It is painful, but it is a sacrifice, and she has lived a life of them. When they come to talk to her, she had forgotten how to speak. She would only write. She draws a picture of her father and his name underneath. They looked him up on the computer and saw that he was alive, but in another place. This one, they explained, through interpreters of interpretations of strange logic she could not follow, was a place for men, so she would not be able to see him. "But he is my father." She thought this question, but she had no words. "When I am silent, I cease to exist." She is told she is in a house of detention. She puzzles over what that meant. I am only in the past or in the future? And if it is written in ink, its words will be washed away in the sea. The words and rules that hold us all here, that hold us all there. A broken hallelujah echoes from the sea to the moon. The sea wants all our tears. It is a resting place of tears. The sea is a moon river of lost tears. And this is how it will end. with the sun setting and the moon rising, with a day of ravage and beauty washed away yet again by the moon as she calls the tide in. The moon then calls the sea to her to watch a little girl place her rocks and shells in a row under her bed, counting her day's find, smiling. They will be there in the morning, just how she sees them now. Each rock she has found is different. Each shell has its own patterning of colour, picture, smoothness and story. As the little girl closes her eyes on the day, the moon holds back rain for as long as possible, but soon it falls, covering the world in an unbearable lightness of being. Thank you. It's just so funny, you know, when you look at all how Australia was colonised with these boats coming from Ireland and then the kind of absolute hostility we have now for people coming out on boats. It's certainly something that is very political in Australia at the moment. But I'm going to move away from that and just leave you with a couple of love poems. While I was finishing my doctorate, which was quite dull in some ways in the final year, as people who have done it probably know, lots of editing, I decided to do a few blue poems. So this one, I chose little blue colours from the paint strips, and this one was called Blue Encounter. So it's a colour of paint. Woolloomooloo, before I go into it, is a place in Australia near Circular Quay, where near the rocks. Blue Encounter. Woolloomooloo with you under a fickle moon. Jeans to respective ankles, you wash my left thigh clean with the salty Sydney harbour. The nor'easterly covers us, and it is just us and the boats docking into a well-lit city. Just us in a dark corner having a blue encounter. And you say, with your usual flair for emotion, this is nice. Okay, two more. Reading all these things I haven't read so late. I think I can do blue sort of, you know, poems. So this one is called Being Satisfied as the Third Person. And it's got a few subheadings. The Price of Living in the Moment, or Feminists Have Feelings Too. I am not the first person you have laid next to in the night. You are not the first person who has laughed at my stories. They are not my first stories. And when I am close to you in the dark, breathing you, kissing you, I am your skin, and you are the book I am in. And when your teeth grip my nipple, when you roll me over, when my arm contorts behind me, when my fingers wedge into your mouth, when I feel your fingers licking them, I beg you to come inside me, silently, for reasons A, B, and C. But you never have, and you never will. And you are right, but you are also wrong. And I am wrong, but I am also right. And sometimes I see the third person, the one that we would create if we both wanted the same story. And I long to hold him to me like I hold you. But you need all the holding I have to give, and I need a lot of holding too. For though I look all strong and solo, that is just the third person getting in the way. And so you will never let yourself go, and I will never have your boy. I will never kiss his little head, never hold another baby of my own. And your beauty will always strike me, and your eyes will always be the sea. And when you look at me that way, when you take me to your bed, when you move deep into me, I know I'm not the first person, not even the second person, to be here, in this story, in this bed. But I am the one right now. And you're the one right now. And that is enough, isn't it? I should be happy with that. I shouldn't need the fiction of a future or the future of a fiction. And it feels enough when I lie beside you, when I wake and I hear you breathing, when you jolt in your sleep and I hold you, when I whisper at 2 a.m. and you answer, when I move my cold feet towards you and you curl them into yours. In that moment, I am your first person. And you are the you of my second person. and we are third person entwined in skin, night, and story.